of scrap lumber to about the size of your van. It was for hitchhikers, to give them shelter and the love of Jesus. This country's tough on hitchers, not like Canada. I wanted to open tree temples all over the country, but the Baptists got sore because I was teaching a different doctrine. They said the temple would attract tramps, and they got the state to come out and run me off and tear it down. That's another instance in American history of showing spite for the underdog, but it proves there are a lot of ways to beat the rat race. You should write a book about it. I'd never write about that. This world isn't worth it. Stories are fine, but salvation is everything. I'll tell you, though, I might write a book about salvation. I'd call it Hitching for Yahweh. In a mountain valley full of greenness and blue water, we stopped to stretch. A historical marker explained the geology of the basin. Backy said, "That sign has a mistake. It says this valley was formed 1 million years ago, but the earth is only 6,000 years old." At Bonner's Ferry, where US 2 ran a long, deep break in the Bitterroot Mountains, we turned toward Montana. I asked why he was going to El Salvador. "My fiancé lives in San Salvador. I'm going there to get married and bring Carmen back if I can raise the money. She's a wonderful woman. Her love freed me from a 10-year obsession with a gospel singer. She's 60 and can't speak English, and I don't speak Spanish, so we have to get our letters translated. But I think maybe we could witness along the Mexican border." He took out an envelope addressed to her. Inside was a letter and a paper placemat with a map of Idaho on it, furnished by the State Beef Association. He marked our route for her and drew heavy X's through the word beef and the color pictures of rump roast and prime rib. "What's going on there?" "Just reminding Carmen we shouldn't eat things that hurt us. Beef, pork, clams, oysters, prawns. Paul says, 'Meat commendeth us not to God.'" I said, "Whatsoever is sold in the shambles, that eat, asking no questions for conscience' sake." "That's Paul, too, somewhere."
"You know scripture?"
"Here and there. I know that one from arguing with a friend who became a vegetarian for a time."
"Well, then,"
Backy said, and buried me in quotation. I had fired my single salvo, but hadn't sunk him. When the Bible has so many interpretations, how do you know your view is right?
"I don't interpret. I read the word as it is and trust the Lord to make me understand. And another thing, understanding depends on how well you know the whole Bible and how the parts fit in."
"You seem to know all the Bible well."
"I know the New Testament better than the Old. I read 4 Old Testament chapters and 4 New Testament chapters 6 days a week, so I get through the whole Bible about twice a year. But the New Testament is less than a third as long, so I get through it more often."
Backy turned toward me.
"I saw you reading this morning. Was it the Bible?"
"The Journals of Lewis and Clark." Lewis was recounting his 31st birthday, which he spent not far from here. He surveyed his life and found he'd done very little with it. He vowed right then to live for others, the way he had been living for himself.
"Some worldly books have the Spirit moving in them."
We rode silently for several miles, and Backy dozed off. A bird swooped the highway and slammed into the hood. The clunk woke him.
"What was that?"
"I hit a bird."
"Why are you stopping?"
"Want to see what kind of bird it is, or was." He got out, too. I picked it up, a warm, crumpled fluff limp in my hand, its talons clenched into tiny fists. "Sparrowhawk," I said.
"Throw it away."
"There is no object so soft but what it makes a hub for the wheeled universe. The poet Walt Whitman said that." Backy smiled. We drove on along the Kootenai River, and he pointed out places that would be certain death if you slid off the pavement. "I want to ask you something personal," I said. "Everything you own, other than your testimonies and typing paper, is in that aluminum suitcase?" He nodded. "Would you show me what's in there? I'm interested in how you've reduced your goods to that box."
"Never call them goods."
He opened the little case and held up the contents one by one. 2 shirts, a pair of pants, underwear, toothbrush and paste, bar of soap,
flashlight, candle, toilet paper, a corn muffin, and a bag of Jolly Time popcorn. I try to live of the gospel, as Paul says. I envy your simplicity. Paul says, set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. Colossians 3:2. The idea is to come away from things, away from ourselves. Come away from it all, toward God. Buying things is an escape. It's showing what you aren't. It's loving yourself. I was still looking at the suitcase. You've got necessities in one box, your work in a briefcase, a creed in your shirt pocket. I admire the compression of it. I wish I could reduce it all to a couple of boxes. I like your self-sufficiency. Don't give me so much credit. Paul preached how pride separates us from God. He opened his small Bible and read, "Walk not as other Gentiles walk, in the vanity of their mind, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them, because of the blindness in their heart." Ephesians 4:17. Maybe so, but for basic necessity, you come close to material self-sufficiency. Becky sat quietly. The college students you talk to, they must admire your on-the-road work, your freedom. I don't think many would trade places with me. Would you? It was a terrible question. I don't have your belief or purpose, but I wish I knew what you know. Knowledge puffeth up, but charity edifieth. If any man think that he knoweth anything, he knoweth nothing, yet as he ought to know. 1 Corinthians 8:1-2. Knowledge of the Lord is the knowledge worth knowing. Walt Whitman says, "Be not curious about God, for I, who am curious about each day, am not curious about God." Becky smiled again. Now you're going to say mortal life is a troublous shadow, aren't you? For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeaseth for a little time and then vanisheth away. James 4:14. I like little appeasing vapors. Let no man deceive himself, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. 1 Corinthians 3:18-19. Why should I wish to see God better than this day? Whitman, Song of Myself. Here's another one from a Sioux medicine man called Black Elk. Whatever you have seen, maybe it is for the good of the people you have seen it. Errors. To know God, to know the city of God, that's the only true life. Maybe this is the city of God. How could it be? The city of God has streets paved with transparent gold. Sounds pretty worldly. That's the standard account in Revelation, isn't it? Yes, Revelation. We rode on in silence to Kalispell, and Becky dozed off again. I looked at him. He seemed one of those men who wander all their lives. In him was something restless and unsatisfied and ancient. He was going everywhere, anywhere, nowhere. He belonged to no place and was at home any place. He understood that the Bible, in spite of its light, isn't a particularly cheerful book, but rather one with much darkness. And he recognized that is where its power comes from. Yet the word he carried to me wasn't of the city of God. It was of simplicity, spareness, courage, directness, trust, and charity in Paul's sense. He lived clean, mind, body, way of life. Hegel believed that freedom is knowledge of one's necessity. And Arthur O. Becky, IMV, was a free man, hindered only by his love and conviction. And that was just as he wanted it. I don't know whether he had been chosen to beat the highways and hedges, but clearly he had chosen to. Despite doctrinal differences, he reminded me of a Trappist monk or a Hopi shaman. I liked Arthur. I liked him very much. Near Kalispell, he woke up. I said, "I'll let you off at the junction of 93 so you can hitch toward Missoula."
"I could ride on with you. I know a friend in North Dakota."
"I've got to go alone, Arthur. For now, I have to go by myself. There'll be times when I'll wish for your company." He hobbled out and came around to my window as gusts again pulled his beard sharply.
We shook hands, and he said, "Carry God's blessing, brother. You'll be all right in this wind, for I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content." Philippians 4:11. Hardships are good. They prepare a man. I believe you.
4. The boy was severely handicapped, trying to fill a big thermos from a spring spewing out of the mountain east of Kalispell, near Hungry Horse. He laughed as the cold water splattered him, and he burbled something. I had no idea what he said.
"Very cold water indeed," I answered.
He burbled again, then lost his footing, and fell hard on the wet rocks. The gush hit the flask and kicked it away. I went to help him.
"Leave him alone!"
someone shouted over the crash of water. A man who looked as if he'd swallowed a nail keg came toward us.
"Let him do it. You'll make him weak if you do it for him. He's my son. He understands."
The boy struggled up and slipped and struggled again. "I'll hand him the thermos."
"Let him get it."
The boy retrieved the jug and went back to the big spout. He fell again, got up, and tried again.
"Grab onto the pipe,"
I shouted, but he couldn't do it and hold the jug. The thermos bounced over to me. I picked it up and handed it to him.
"He'll never survive if he gets turned into a pussy," the father said.
"He'll never survive if he dies filling a thermos jug."
"Malarkey! We're on our way now to float a branch of the Flathead. That river's a bad-tempered horse, and you'd better stay on top of it or it'll beat your liver out. This little gimp's got more whitewater time than most of those canoe daredevils, and he can't even swim. Just never learned fear."
The boy succeeded in filling the jug. I filled mine and drank off a pint. My teeth ached from the cold, and I grimaced. The boy watched and did the same thing, but his grimace was too real.
"Glory, is that cold," I said to him.
"And good."
"God and good,"
he repeated. The father stepped in to fill a jug.
"On our way home," he said with authority, "I'll fill a 5-gallon can. I'll tell you something. I used to go through 60 suppositories a month, 2 a day. Last year, I started mixing this water with a teaspoon of cayenne and equal parts of nutmeg and flour. Now I don't even use 6 tablets a month."
"You attribute healing power to this water?"
"Water's got nothing to do with it. It's the cayenne, nutmeg, and flour."
"That's different."
"Nobody believes me. If you ever get hemorrhoids, try it. And don't worry about thanking me. I never could thank the old boy I got it from."
Eastward. US 2, up the long canyon of the middle fork of the Flathead River. To the north, gusts scoured gritty snow from one wind-shorn peak to another. Mount Despair, Mount Rampage, Mount Scalplock, Mount Duty. In a crevasse, I stopped to watch 6 mountain goats cling to the canyon wall. The mountain goat isn't a goat at all, but rather a relative of the antelope, and one proved it by bounding ledge to ledge, each time sticking like an arrow. The highway ascended the west slope of the Continental Divide. In the middle of the pavement at the top of Marias Pass stood a tall limestone obelisk marking the divide and also commemorating Teddy Roosevelt, your basic double-duty monument. Then the great mountains of the west lay behind, and sweeping ahead mile after terribly visible mile of roadway across a grandly canceled plateau were the grasslands of the Big Sky Country. The state of Montana had marked spots of fatal car crashes with small pole-mounted steel crosses, one cross for every death. Along the highway, as it traversed the Blackfeet Reservation, the little white crosses piled up like tumbleweed. A single, a pair, a triple, a half dozen, a group of 9. What began as an automobile safety campaign, the Blackfoot, once among the best of Indian horsemen, had turned into roadside shrines by wiring on plastic flowers. Somebody later told me the abundance of crosses around the reservation was proof of chronic alcoholism. The reservation town of Browning, unlike Hopi or Navajo settlements, was pure USA. An old hamburger stand of poured concrete in the shape of a teepee, but now replaced by the Whoopee Burger Drive-In, the Warbonnet Lodge Motel, a radio shack, a Tasty Freeze. east of town, I read a historical marker that said the Blackfeet had jealously preserved their tribal customs and traditions. Render therefore unto Caucasians the things which be Caucasian. At Cutbank, the rangeland and wheat fields and oil wells began. Montanans call US-2, paralleling the Canadian border all the way to Lake Huron, the High Line. The most desolate of the great east-west routes, it was two lanes of patched, broken, rutted, mind-numbing pavement, running from horizon to horizon over the land of god-awful distance. I stopped at Shelby. Shelby used to be on the old Whoop-Up Trail, a route followed by Missouri River whiskey traders who sold to Indians. What the U.S. Army could not accomplish, the destruction of tribal organization, whiskey traders did, with help from Christian missionaries who suppressed the old rituals. The white settlers, moving in after tribal disintegration opened this land, should have erected a monument to the whiskey bottle. The Blackfoot, for example, once hunted an area about twice the size of Montana. Now their reservation of steel crosses and whoopee burgers doesn't occupy even all of Glacier County. It isn't that Indians lost their land because of whiskey, that stuff they call the Great Father's milk. They just lost it faster because of whiskey. The Husky Cafe truck stop, glowing warm in the spring wind, was one of those places with a rack of joke postcards about fishing weekends, outhouses, mule croppers, I'm the one on the left, and full-color photographs of spotted fawns and antlered jackrabbits. At the counter and tables sat the Diesel Boys in their adjustable ventilated caps that said Mac, GMC, Kenworth, White. I seldom go into truck stops. When I hear Teamster cant about being the self-professed son of a bitches of the highway, when I hear stories of retreads shredding at 70, when I watch drivers trying to recuperate on coffee and chili, and look at faces with eyes bloodshot from pocket rockets, and witness their ludicrous attempts to be folk heroes, I get very nervous the next time I see one pushing 40 tons, 70 miles an hour at me. But that night in Shelby, I didn't have much choice. One 18-wheel stud said to the waitress, "Hon, you know, don't you, that old truckers never die. They just get a new Peterbilt." "I have heard that about a goddamn million times." She had the skin of a Dresden figurine and the mouth of a Freuhoff driver. "They say the drive in your shaft's about shot." Automatically, she pushed a mug of coffee under my menu. "What's it for you, Hoss?" Someone cracked another joke at her. Looking at me, answering him, she said, "Teach your old lady to suck eggs." I ordered two eggs anyway, a slab of hash browns and a cut of ham. The conversation next to me was about a trucker killed in a wreck. He had been pulling a fat load of 50,000 pounds of hanging beef in a reefer well above legal speed. "Heard Bouncer bought pork over to Black Eagle," one said. "Was he up?" A garrulous teamster whose handle was Rubber Lip said, "That wasn't it. Half-ton come on the other way and tossed a brick straight in the air and let him run into it. Half-ton was probably doing 80, so that brick come through the windshield at 150 mile an hour. He had union problems all along. May no tongue gonna tell for sure now, but that union bull is cover-up. Some seat cover's old man finally got word on him. He'd pornicate a snake if you held its head." The waitress slid a platter of three eggs down her arm. "Only ordered two," I said. "The eggs was small tonight." 5. What does the traveler do at night in a strange town when he wants conversation? In the United States, there's usually a single choice, a tavern. The Oil City Bar was north of the railroad tracks, near the spot where the Great Northern accidentally founded Shelby in 1891 by dumping off an old boxcar. From it, the town grew, and the antecedents still showed. One of the authors of the Montana Federal Writers Project described Shelby in the 1890s as the sort of town that producers of Western movies have ever since been trying to reproduce in papier-mâché. The town playboys were featured in the Police Gazette after holding up an opera troupe passing through on a railroad train. The men shot out the engine headlight, the car windows, and the red signal lights, and forced the conductor to execute a clog dance.
I was out looking around to see how the old Wild West was doing when I came across the Oil City Bar. Although the night had turned cold and gusty, only the screen door was closed. The wooden one stood open so men in down vests wouldn't overheat. A shattered pool cue lay in the corner, and to one side was a small room lighted only by the blue neon flicker of a beer sign, the kind of light you could go mad in. Left of the 10-point buck trophy, and above the gallon jars of pickled pig's feet and hard-boiled eggs, hung a big lithograph of a well-formed woman, shotgun in hand. She was duck hunting. Other than her rubber boots, she wore not a stitch. A man, somewhat taller than the barstool, and dressed in yellow from shoulders to cowboy boots, drank with assembly line regularity. He leered wobbly-eyed at the huntress, tried to speak, but blew a bubble instead. I blame what was about to happen to him on the traditional design of the American bar. A straight counter facing a mirrored wall, which forces the customer to stare at himself or put a crick in his neck looking at someone else. The English build their bars in circles or horseshoes or right angles, anything to get another face in your line of sight. Their bars, as a result, are more sociable. For the American, he stares into his own face, or at bottles of golden liquors, or at whatever hangs above the bar. Conversation declines and drinking increases. If the picture above the bar is a nude, as is common in old Western bars, you have an iconography for creating unfulfilled desire. The reality of a man's own 6 o'clock face below the dream of perfect flesh. I turned away from the huntress to watch a pool game. There was a loud flump beside me. Knees to his chest, the man in yellow lay dead drunk on the floor. He looked like a cheese curl. His friend said, "Chucky's one good little drinker." A woman of sharp face, pretty 10 years ago, kept watching me. She had managed to pack her hips into what she hoped was a pair of mean jeans. A cigarette was never out of her mouth, and after every deep draw, her exhalations were smokeless. She was trying for trouble, but I minded my own business, more or less. The man with her, Lonnie, walked up to me. He looked as if he were made out of whipcord. "Like that lady?" he said. "What lady is that? One you've been staring at?" Without my glasses, I can't distinguish a man from a woman. That was a lie. "The lady said you were distinguishing her pretty good." Well, boys, there you have it. Some fading face trying to make herself the center of men's anger, proving she could still push men to their limits. Couldn't recognize her from here if I did know her. He pressed up close. Trouble coming. "Don't tell me," he said. "Happens all the time. She thinks men stare at her." "Look, no offense, but I've no interest in the woman. I can see it, and she can see it, and that's the trouble. But let's talk." It was an act he had been coerced into. He was faking it. He called for 2 beers and set one in front of me. "Take it," he said. "When I sit down, I'm going to tell her you apologize for staring, but you just thought she was one hell of a fox. Don't make a liar out of me." He walked off. That was the silliest row I never got into. I went to the restroom. When I came out, Lonnie was standing at the bar, and the woman had gone to sit with 3 other women. She didn't buy it, I thought. Drifter blown away in bar. "Trouble?" I said. "Forget it. She works with those broads, castrating bitches, everyone." There was a commotion that got loud and moved outside to the windy street. 2 men from Mountain Bell, the phone company, were going to fight. They came at each other, locked outstretched arms and pushed, circling slowly, as if turned by the prairie wind. They tired and revolved slower, but neither let go or fell down. A police car drove up and honked. The fighters went to the squad car, both leaning on the window to listen. After a while, they slumped off in opposite directions, and that was the end of it. Lonnie and I watched from the bar. After it was over, he said, "Jack Dempsey had a real fight here." "A fight in this very bar?" "Not a bar fight. Heavyweight boxing. Shelby built a grandstand for it. 40,000 seats. 7,000 people showed up. Town almost went bust." The woman came over to Lonnie and said, "Let's go." She was mad. I left soon after, walking out into the streets of the new Wild West. 6. The first thing I knew that morning in Shelby was that I was catching cold. My throat felt like a cat had got a paw down it and scratched out a strip. Then I saw the day, blustery and foul. I went back to the Husky Grill and let them fill me with potato skin hash browns and eggs and their hot, fierce coffee. I was trying to burn out the cold, the weather, trying to get ready for a long passage across the Great Plains of the North. A man wearing denim, hat, jacket, pants, boots, and probably even his shorts, sat down beside me. "Is that your truck with the Missouri tags?" he asked. I told him it was. He said, "Should have named the Missouri River the Montana, you know. That damned river, and I'm not cussing, is born, you might say, due south of here a ways, and we got more miles of it than you people down south." "Might as well call the Mississippi the Minnesota, then," I said. "Anyway, explorers named the Missouri after Indians who lived along it." "So where'd those Indians live?" "In Missouri." "That's what I'm saying. Doesn't stand to reason. The men who named it didn't know where the river came from. They saw the bottom end first. That's how the jackass got named." I asked where he was from. "Next county over? Liberty County? Only 3 other Liberty counties in the country. For the talking Americans do about freedom, I'd say that's interesting. Tell me a county not named after a man or an Indian tribe." "Well, you have... there's..." I couldn't do it. 3,000 and some counties in the country and half are Jefferson, Jackson, Johnson, Monroe, Madison, Washington, or Lincoln. What's your county?"
"Born in Jackson, but I live in Boone."
He smiled.
"I've studied it. In Montana? We got Beaverhead, Deer Lodge, Silver Bow, Petroleum, Sweetgrass, Wheatland, Rosebud, even one called Muscle Shell. But the nation's got a problem. No counties left to name things after. No rivers or mountains either. Got to use freeways now."
He started to say something else when a woman put her head in the door and blasted us with cold, wet air.
"Clay, late again," she shouted.
"Coming," he said. "So long, Jackson."
"Talk about names," a man who sold potato chips said and pushed a receipt in front of me. "First and Last Chance Liquors, 202 Brontosaurus Boulevard, Dinosaur, Colorado.
Try spelling Brachiosaurus Bypass or Triceratops Terrace in the morning," he said.
Time for the road. People who equate travel with getting the miles behind them love US 2, as it strikes a more or less flat, straight line for 1,000 miles across the north. The great ice sheets cut the tops off the hills and dumped glacial debris in the valleys so that nothing interrupts the rush of wind off the east slopes of the Rockies. On that May morning, the wind came strong at my back, and a square stern of Ghost Dancing served as sail. Even resting easy on the accelerator, I blew past clusters of buildings that had gotten the way of two, so they could call themselves towns. Joplin, Rudyard, Hingham, Guildford, Kremlin. Russian settlers, half mad from the vast openness and a sway of prairie grass, thought they saw the citadel of Moscow. Tractor trailers, noses to the wind, hammers to the floor, highballed west. Drivers wrapped in the CB chatter of their cabs. The mountains would slow them, but they had the Great Plains behind. What little topographical relief there was came from creeks notching the tablelands. Cottonwoods, like cattle, followed the stream beds for water and escape from the wind. Indian children used to twirl leaves of the holy tree of life into toy teepees, and women made a brew from the inner bark to soothe stomach disorders. Sprigs fed Indian ponies in winter, the catkins lured grouse in spring, and in summer everyone searched hollows of the trunks for wild honey. A white inner pulp furnished a delicacy later called cottonwood ice cream. When settlers arrived, they cut the biggest cottonwoods for lumber, although it was prone to warping, and Missouri rivermen fueled steamboats with it. White men learned they needed the tree, too, so they set out thousands of seedlings. But today the cottonwood still keeps to the streams,
as if it knows the primogeniture of the grasses. Clear Creek, typically, ran full with an earthen goo the ducks could walk more easily than swim, but it was the only surface water for miles. Yet the language of the plains harks to the ocean. Pioneers came in prairie schooners, some even rigged with sails, and spoke of the sea of grass and the prairie ocean, and they cured hangovers with calf bollocks they called prairie oysters. Maybe the sodbusters saw seascapes in the undulations of the grasses, or in the immensity of sky, or in the lack of refuge from wind and storm. Perhaps a sea crossing was still in the minds of the newest immigrants. And maybe also their words expressed a prescient awareness of the tug between coming and going. For the buffalo grass, the wheat, and rye spring from the limestone bones of ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs lying under stony blankets of the ancient seabed, where molecules turn to soil and cellulose. Perhaps those people of the land knew the cycle, Whitman's perpetual transfers. That time mineral, this time vegetable, next time animal, sometime man. The grasses. Mile after mile after mile. Miles. Then mile marker 465. By afternoon, half of Montana still lay ahead, with the even flatter plains of North Dakota yet to come. For a state whose name is Mountain, Montana shows thousands of miles of level prairie. I've read that if all the space within the atoms of the Earth were pressed out, the planet would have a diameter of 328 feet, not even the distance of a good major league home run. I don't know whether it's possible to believe that figure, but I do know if you're driving across Montana, you'll never believe it. Puck, puck, went the tarred road cracks. Puck, puck. The day remained dark. Showers fell and stopped and came again. The uneven roadway collected water. The van hydroplaned every few minutes. The clamor of wind numbed my ears. The fever made me woozy. Puck, puck. First the highway held me. Then it entered me. Then I was the highway. Puck, 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 puck. Prairie hypnosis. I drove miles I couldn't remember, and the land became a succession of wet highway stripes, and I wished for a road fellow. I sat blindly, dumbly, like a veiled stone sphinx. Finally, to dispel the miles, I stopped, got out, and held my face to the rain. I shook myself. But once more on the road, I again became part of the machine, generator, accelerator, humanator. I knew nothing. A stupefied nub on the Great Prairie. East of where the muddy Milk River begins rubbing its back against the highway, I stopped again, climbed a fence, and walked out to a pair of rusty boulders that an ice sheet dropped on its northward retreat. Stones like these the Indians carved into billboards, scorecards, boundary markers, prayer books. I hoped for a message from the First People, but the stones sat as featureless as the land. Back in the truck, I fired my little stove to heat water for coffee. I threw in some cocoa for energy and sat and watched and sipped. The prairie was blowing and gray, interrupted here and about by the white faces of Herefords. A century ago, the Sioux tribes, Assiniboines, Stone Boilers, and Gros Ventre, Big Bellies, who hunted bison on these plains, found in those descendants of the mastodons a four-legged grocery, hardware, and dry goods store. For generations, the people stalked buffalo and dried and pulverized the meat and mixed it with bone marrow grease and wild berries and packed it in buffalo skin bags. The pemmican lasted indefinitely and had 10 times the nutrient value of fresh meat. Tanned bison hides gave the Sioux shelters and bedding, moccasins, leggings, shields, boats, buckets, even vessels to boil food in. Horn and bone gave spikes, drills, knives, scrapers, axes, and spoons. Ribs and jawbones provided children with snow sleds. The hooves furnished glue, the scat, heat. When a Sioux finished with a buffalo, he had used all of it, even its spirit, for it was the bearded buffalo, alive and dangerous, weighing nearly a ton, snorting and short-tempered, that stood at the heart of the rituals and religion of the Plains Indians. Until the ghost dance generation, the one that kissed the old life goodbye to face an enemy future, The tribes that dominated these grasslands for 8,000 years fought most of their battles over hunting territory. The red man ate buffalo, transubstantiation in the Indian manner. He dressed in buffalo, he imitated and talked to it, and he died for and by the sacred buffalo. Then the future came wearing shoes cut out of cows and pants woven on a machine. It found bison a nuisance. The beasts took valuable grass from cattle, stampeded crops, interrupted trains, knocked over telegraph lines. And so the American bison, a symbol to both red and white, disappeared even faster than the way of life it engendered. I put my mug away as the unsexed Hereford steers chewed blankly in the grasses where once buffalo bulls, shaggy pizzles almost touching the ground, red eyes glaring over their females, had roamed. I remembered reading that 1 out of 9 beef cows ends up in a McDonald's hamburger. The sky had been cloudy all day, and now I'd just heard a discouraging word. Again to the pock-pocking. The road shook and pounded me. The seat slammed my spine. The steering wheel rattled my knuckles. I felt like a watch in a Timex commercial. I could hear John Cameron Swayze. "We strapped this man in a truck on a Montana highway for 2 days. He took a licking, but..." etc. I turned on the radio. Amidst the crackles, a revivalist was at work on a sermon shot through with real thunderbolts. Between heavenly interferences, I heard his Amazing Grace voice, "Thou knowest, O Lord, we shall pass this way but once." Amen. Darkness came early. At Wolf Point, a lightning storm struck the benchland. Rain dropped in noisy assaults, and I took refuge in town. Dim houses, bound in by nothing but the Missouri River on the south, huddled each to the other, and streets were slick with mud and full of brown pools. I had to go back to the highway for dinner at a truck stop. Something moved in there. I couldn't say what. 6 people sat in the cafe, in the light and warmth, almost assured by the jukebox, and filled their stomachs. Yet there was an edge to the voices, to the faces. From 1,000 feet up, the prairie storm, pouring cold water on the little cafe glowing in the blackness, held us all. Even as we ate our soup and steak and eggs, we felt the sky. Again into town. A foot of oily water swirled in a railroad underpass where 2 cars had collided. A police light twisted, turning raindrops crimson, and a man's still face pressed against the window. I slipped past and found a street for the night. The rain, hostile and forbidding, thundered on the steel roof. Unable to see anything in the deep black, I crawled into the sleeping bag and listened to the tumult. One November in another century, before Wolf Point had a name, the citizens complained of wolves. They got together and set out poison, and the varmints died all over the prairie, and townsmen stacked 1,000 frozen carcasses into high mounds that stood all winter. When spring came, the mounds thawed and rotted. One man thought the stink drove away the remaining wolves. Whatever it was, nobody saw a wolf alive, and nobody since has seen one here. On my night in Wolf Point, Montana, I couldn't imagine man or beast contending for the place. 7. In Poplar, Montana, where Sitting Bull surrendered 6 years after the Battle of the Little Bighorn, I stopped for groceries. Having resisted a chewing hunger for 5 days, before meals, after meals, and moments of half-sleep, I gave in to it east of Wolf Point and bought 1 pound of raisins, 1 pound of peanuts, 1 pound of chocolate nibs, and mixed them together. By the time I got across North Dakota, the bag was empty, the hunger gone. U.S. 2 followed the Missouri River for miles. At the high-line town of Culbertson, I turned north toward treeless Plentywood, Montana, then went east again down forsaken Blue Highway 5, a road virtually on the 49th parallel, which is the Canadian border in North Dakota. In a small flourish of hills, the last I was to see for hundreds of miles, on an upthrusted lump sat a cube of concrete with an Air Force radar antenna sweeping the long horizon for untoward blips. A Martello tower of the 20th century. Below the installation, in the Ice Age land, lay a fine, clear lake. Fingerlings whisked the marshweed. Coots twittered on the surface, and at bankside a muskrat munched greens. It seemed as if I were standing between two worlds, but they were one. A few permutations of life going on about themselves, each thing trying to continue its way. East of Fortuna, North Dakota, just 8 miles south of Saskatchewan, the high moraine wheat fields took up the whole landscape. There was nothing else, except piles of stones like Viking burial mounds at the verges of tracts, and big rock pickers running steely fingers through the glacial soil to glean stone that freezes had heaved to the surface. Behind the machines, the fields looked vacuumed. At a filling station, a man who long had farmed the moraine said the great ice sheets had gone away only to get more rock.
"They'll be back. They always come back. What's to stop them?"
The country gave up the glacial hills and flattened to perfection. The road went on, straight and straight. Ahead and behind, it ran through me like an arrow. North Dakota up here was a curveless place. Not just roads, but land, people too, and the flight of birds. Things were angular, fence posts against the sky, the line of a jaw, the ways of mind, the lay of crops. The highway, oh, the highway. No place, in theory, is boring of itself. Boredom lies only with the traveler's limited perception and his failure to explore deeply enough. After a while, I found my perception limited. The Great Plains, showing so many miles in an immodest exposure of itself, wearied my eyes. The openness was overdrawn. The only mitigation came from potholes ice sheets had gouged out. There, margins and water were full of stilt-legged birds, godwits, sandpipers, plovers, dowitchers, avocets, yellowlegs, and paddling birds, coots, mallards, canvasbacks, redheads, blue-winged teals, pintails, shovelers, scops, mergansers, eared grebes, widgeons, Canada geese. Whenever the drone of tread against pavement began to overcome me, I'd stop and shake the drowsiness among the birds. You'd think anything giving variety to this near blankness would be prized, yet when a Pleistocene pond got in the way, the road cut right through it, never yielding its straightness to nature. If you fired a rifle down the highway, a mile or so east you'd find the spent slug in the middle of the blacktop. Here the earth, as if to prove its immensity, empties itself. Gertrude Stein said, "In the United States there is more space where nobody is than where anybody is. That is what makes America what it is." The uncluttered stretches of the American West and the deserted miles of roads force a lone traveler to pay attention to them by leaving him isolated in them. This squander of land substitutes a sense of self with a sense of place by giving him days of himself until, tiring of his own small compass, he looks for relief to the bigness outside, a grandness that demands attention not just for its scope, but for its age, its diversity, its continual change. The isolating immensity reveals what lies covered in places noisier, busier, more filled up. For me, what I saw revealed was this, only this. A man nearly desperate because his significance had come to lie within his own narrow ambit. Onward across the appallingly featureless yonder of North Dakota, where towns, like the poor verse of Burma Shave signs, came and went quickly. On across fields where farmers planted wheat, rye, barley, and flax, their tractors sowing close to fences marking off missile silos that held Minutemen waiting in the dark underground like seeds of another sort. As daylight went, the men, racing rain and the short growing season, switched on headlights to keep the international harvesters moving over cropland that the miracles of land-grant colleges, cross-pollinated hybrids, resistant to everything but growth and petrochemicals, had changed forever. The farmer's enemy wasn't a radar blip. It was the wild oat. At last, the horizon ruptured at the long hump of Turtle Mountain, obscurely scrubby against the sky, and a pair of silent owls, Indians called them hush wings, swooped the dusk to look for telltale movements in the fields. I needed a hot shower. In Rolla, on the edge of the Turtle Mountain Reservation, I stopped in an old house rebuilt into a small hotel. Despite a snarl of a clerk, it looked pleasant. But the floors smelled of disinfectant, and the shower was a rusting box at the end of the hall. The nozzle sent one stinging jet of water into my eye, another up my nose, two others over the shower curtain, while most of the water washed down the side to stand icily in the plugged bottom. I lost my temper and banged the shower head, the Neanderthal remedy. In a hotel room at the geographical center of North America, a neon sign blinking red through the cold curtains, I lay quietly like a small idea in a vacant mind. 8. East of Rolla. After breakfast in the city park at Langdon, a Nordic town of swept streets and tidy pastel houses with pastel shutters at the picture windows, a town with the crack of Little League bats in the clear Saturday air, a town of blonde babies and mothers wearing 100% acrylics, and of husbands washing pastel cars to kill time before the Major League game of the week, this happened. In the park, a man walking with a child saw me staring at a retired Spartan missile that now apparently served the same function as courthouse lawn field pieces with little pyramids of cannonballs once did. The white Spartan, a skeletal finger pointing into the beyond, was undefaced by initials, lover's notations, graduating class years, or spray can anarchy. The only blemishes were a smudgy ring of handprints from children who attested the reality of the thing, and, penciled small near the bottom as if to hide it, this. Warning. The Surgeon General has determined that smoking ICBMs are dangerous to your health. "She's a nook," the father said with proprietary pride. His shirt sleeves were rolled to the elbows, and he carried a full complement of ballpoint pens in a plastic pocket protector above his heart. "We're lucky to have her here. Came from a silo down at Nikoma. Air Force selected our town. I've seen a lot of missile installations along the highway. Make you feel good, don't they? Proud and taken care of, like?" "Taken care of, that's it. From a distance, in the right light, this bird looks like a church steeple. And I promise you, if these things ever start flying, she'll be the mother we'll be praying to. Our Lady of the Unholy Boom?" He ignored me. "I don't mean these old Spartans, of course. I'm talking about the new Minutemen, or the MX, when it gets approved. And it will. 10 nuke warheads on the MX. His daughter fell on the grass. Without a drop of irony, he cautioned her to be careful. "Do you believe they'll be used?" I asked. "This one's deactivated, of course. But I promise you we're ready for the Soviets up here. That border is only 17 miles away. You ask if they'll ever be fired. As long as Moscow is insane for conquest, don't bet against it." He waited for a response, then flagged his arm to the northeast. "Wahala's the next town over, and you know what that is." "What is it?" "The home of warriors slain in battle. The place the Valkyrie carry heroes to. We're ready here on the perimeter." "The Air Force is ready, you mean?" "I don't tell tales out of school, but some of us are personally equipped."
"With what?"
"Let's just say we have basements stocked for whoever crosses that border."
"I hope you don't have the other cast-off ICBMs in your rumpus rooms."
"Everybody worries about ICBMs. We live on top of them up here. We grow the bread you and the Russians eat right over the missiles. You want to worry? Worry about IBM. Worry about bug bombs. But with what the generals got over there in the Ukraine, those ICBMs that carry 10 times the kilotons of our biggest, don't fret yourself about this baby." Parentally patting the Spartan, he dislodged the ballpoints in his pocket protector, then repositioned them precisely to make sure he would reach the aftermath free of ink stains.
9.
There was something stretched about the landscape, as if all dimension but length had been pulled from it. It seemed incapable of hiding anything. That may be why I was surprised when Route 5 dropped sharply off the drift plains into another dimension of the tree-filled valley of the Tongue River. The buffy western soil was now the color of hazelnuts, and I knew I was nearly across the prairie. The nickname of North Dakota is the Flickertail State. That morning I saw why. Mile after mile, the small ground squirrels stood at attention along the highway. As my truck approached one, the little rodent would make a madcap high-tailed dash for the other side, only to stop a couple of feet from the shoulder before turning around and making a last-ditch dive for the side it had started from. Again and again it happened. It looked like some sort of crazy game in which the losers were mashed clots of fur. Over many of the flattened rodents, a second one stood. I thought they mourned, but someone later told me flickertails have a keen tooth for flickertail flesh. A sign pointed north to Baku. Baku, North Dakota, may not be the only town in America named after an Australian river, the Barku, but then again, maybe it is. I went to see it, or as it turned out, to see what was left, which was the Burlington Northern Tracks, a grain elevator, grocery, boarded-up school, church, and a thimble of a post office. The town had closed for Saturday, so I started back to the highway when the smell of gasoline stopped me. I lifted the hood. The fuel line below the gas filter had split and was arcing a fine jet of no lead into the sunlight. I tried to wire it closed, but it didn't work. I made for Cavalier, the nearest town. Had I not gone to Baku, the line would have ruptured in Cavalier instead of miles up the road, so logic would dictate. The fact is, engine malfunctions happen only in places like Baku, North Dakota, axiom of the Blue Road. The gauge, visibly, dropped toward E, and the long miles went on. Damn, did they go on. I couldn't remember how much money I had left, but I did know strangers with stalled vehicles get soaked in isolated towns. Axiom of the Blue Road. That 2-inch plastic gas line, of course, should cost no more than a quarter. But in the realm of high technology, you don't figure the simplicity or inexpense of an element. You calculate availability. At Cavalier, I pulled into the first garage I saw, and a teenaged boy with the belly of a man came out and stared. People don't just throw words around in the North. I lifted the hood to show him the line. I didn't speak either. "Some bitch is likely to catch fire," he said. "I know that. Can you fix it? Pull the some bitch in the bay fast and shut her down. Goddamn." He backed off a safe distance as I drove in. "Have you got that hose?" "Here it comes," I thought. He pointed toward a big coil of hose hanging on the greasy wall. "Fix every some bitch in the state if we had to." The boy's blackened hands grappled with the connection. He struggled, cut himself, cursed, and took off on an analgesic tour of the grease pit, blood seeping from his oily finger. I picked up the pliers and tried to free the clamp. My hand slipped as the connection popped loose and I cut my finger. The boy sliced a piece of hose off the coil and clamped it in place. "That'll take care of the sumbitch," he said. "Very speedy service. What do I owe you?" "Here we go. A dime for the hose and $2 for labor. That'll take care of the leak, but it won't do nothing about the real problem under your hood." "Here it comes for sure. Water pump's about to go." He grabbed the fan blades and pulled them back and forth. "Shouldn't be no play in the fan. When those bearings give, fan's coming through your radiator, and that'll be all she wrote." "I've been keeping an eye on it. How long's it been like that?" "About 9,000 miles, I guess." He slapped his forehead to indicate my stupidity. "Some bitch. Trying to buy a little time." "You're gonna buy a lot more than time when that some bitch goes. I wouldn't even drive the some bitch to Hoople." "How far's Hoople? 18 miles? "Can you fix it?" "Wouldn't try. Take the some bitch to the Ford dealer." So I did. The serviceman said, "Can't get parts on Saturday. In fact, I couldn't get a pump before Monday afternoon, if then. All of our parts come out of Grand Forks, so you might as well drive down there yourself." "Can I make it?" For 9,000 miles, I hadn't worried, but now I worried about 70. "Quien sabe, partner? You know?
Maybe you make it home. Then again, maybe you won't make it to Hoople.
I went down State 18 toward Grand Forks and wondered what this Hoople place was that figured as a basic guide to distance in Pembina County, North Dakota. I couldn't get to Grand Forks before 5 o'clock, so I drove slowly, relaxed in my fate. The truck had carried me to the Atlantic Ocean, and then to the Pacific, and halfway back to the Atlantic. But now, of course, the sumbitch might not make it to Hoople. 10. Who in America would guess that Grand Forks, North Dakota, was a good place to be stuck in with a bad water pump? Skyscrapers from the 30s, clean as a Norwegian kitchen, a state university with brick, big trees, and ivy. On Monday morning, the pump got replaced in an hour for $37.50. I had expected to be taken for 3 times that figure, but I met only honest people. I drove up the valley of the Red River of the North, which empties into Hudson Bay, and crossed into Oslo, Minnesota. Near Viking, tall stalks from the sunflower crop of a year earlier rattled in the warm wind. For miles, I had been seeing a change in the face of the Northland, brought about because Americans find it easier to clean house paint out of brushes with water than with turpentine. This area once grew much of the flax that linseed oil comes from, but with the advent of water-based paint, the demand for flax decreased. In its stead, of all things, came the sunflower, and now it was becoming the big cash crop of the Dakotas and Minnesota, with more acreage going each year to new hybrids developed from Russian seeds, because flour is a row crop that farmers can economically reap by combine after the grain harvest. Thief River Falls, another town of Nordic cleanliness, reportedly got its name through an odd mingling of history and language. A group of Dakota Sioux lived on the rich hunting grounds here for some years. Although the bellicose Chippewa controlled the wooded territory, the Dakotas managed to conceal a remote settlement by building an earthen wall around it and disappearing inside whenever the enemy came near. They even hunted with bows and arrows rather than risk the noise of guns. But the Chippewa finally found them out and annihilated them. Because the mounds hid a portion of the river, the Chippewa referred to it as Secret Earth River. Through some error, early white traders called it Stealing Earth River. Through additional misunderstanding, it came to be Thief River. As for Crookston downstream, it took its name from a railroad man. South of Thief River Falls on U.S. 59, I crossed the Clearwater River, but this one, unlike a dozen others of that name I'd seen in the past weeks, was true to its description. It drained a country that became increasingly heavy with aspen, birch, pine, and spruce. I had come to the western edge of the North Woods. The prairie was gone. On the Clearwater River and upstream from Clearwater Lake and down the highway from the hamlet of Clear Brook was the seat of Clearwater County, Bagley, a village with pines and a blue lake, a village where the names on the buildings were Luckeson, Olson, Peterson, Lundmark. I stopped for the night and went to the Viking House Cafe for a Viking omelet, cheese, ham, green peppers, onions, and a chocolate milkshake. To the waitress in long flaxen braids, I said, "Who's the most famous native son of Bagley, Minnesota?" "Oh, my golly, I'll ask the cook." When she returned with dinner, she said, "That would be Richard Davids, author of How to Talk to Birds." Two old men, spectacles like dusty windows, sat slurping broth and arguing about Indian net fishing on the Lake of the Woods Reservation in the northwest angle, the northernmost part of the lower 48.
"I never caught an Indian net," one said, "but I never discouraged a fishing partner from cutting. No redskin should have to buy a license to fish reservation land, but he ought to fish fair."
The words came slowly, with long pauses. In the silences, the soft clacking of dentures.
"Indians got first rights," the other said. "They fish for a living. You fish for fun. Law's law, or it ain't law."
The waitress said, "You boys on the fishing rights again?" They had trouble hearing her, although she spoke louder than either of them. Maybe after so many years they didn't need to hear each other. Louder, she asked,
Who won the argument tonight?
I did, they said.
It's a good friendship where everyone's a winner.
What's that, honey? They said.
I walked down to the bakery.